is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I am Chinedu Ofor, and here's what's coming up.
Me? I've said it many times. I have not been vaccinated, and I will not be vaccinated.
That was Reverend Kenneth Moshoi, leader of the African Christian Democratic Party, who organized protests around South Africa this weekend against the possibility of mandatory COVID-19 vaccination. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. French President Emmanuel Macron denounced as an, quote, unforgivable crime, unquote, a bloody crackdown on Algerian protesters by police in Paris 60 years ago. Analysts say that even though Macron stopped short of offering a full apology, this so far is the strongest recognition by a French president of the massacre in which over 200 Algerian demonstrators were killed by French police and over 12,000 arrested. Reporter Linda Grandstein joins VOA's Jackson Vungani to speak on the significance of this event in French political history and how it affects the current discourse on French-Algerian relations.
The Algerian War of Independence was really into its final phase. It lasted until 1962. But for those Algerians who were living in France, they were subject to very strict curfews, in fact. And it was in October 1961 that members of the Algerian National Liberation Front, based here in Paris, called on Algerians to go out and demonstrate, because they felt it was unfair of the Paris police to have them under curfew. It was a very strict curfew. It was a curfew against anyone who was French Algerian, anyone who was considered Algerian Muslim. They had to stay home. And on that day, those few days, in fact, some 20 to 30,000 Algerians turned up and demonstrated. Now, around 12,000 of those demonstrators were taken into custody. Some died, some were beaten, some were kept in custody for a very long period of time. Exact numbers are not unknown. The Elysee Palace, the official office of the French president's office, said that several dozen died when they were thrown into the River Seine. Other people, particularly Algerian academics, say between 100 and 200 people died in that weekend. So no exact number as to how many died, but certainly it was a large number. And you know, perhaps no one will ever know. At the time, the only indication people got that people had been thrown into the river was a few days later, bodies started turning up, washed up on the shores of the River Seine in central Paris.
Right. And it's possible that some of that information might be known by the government, but it's still under wraps, because I've seen some researchers who say that during their research that they've been kind of hampered, or some of the information around it was not made available to them. Now, President Macron is the first French leader to attend this commemoration. Why did it take this long for the French government to acknowledge this massacre and that has been called a state crime by many? And does this amount to an official apology?
This does not amount to an official apology at all. In fact, although President Emmanuel Macron did go to an area of the River Seine over the weekend and he laid flowers, he stopped well short of an official apology. In fact, he said that what the Paris police did was inexcusable, unforgivable. But that was as far as he went. And a lot of people have been saying it's time for him to go further. President Macron is the first French president to be born after the Algerian War of Independence. He's a president who has continually talked about the need for France to recognize what happened during that colonial period. But he did not apologize. And in fact, one of the criticisms that's been made of him this weekend is that he blamed this entire event on the Paris police. He didn't mention that the Paris police quite possibly operated under the orders of the Prime Minister or the Interior Minister or even the French President of the day.
So what does this timing mean for the French-Algerian relations? That there's clearly tension between the two countries based on France's decision to reduce the number of visas for Algerian citizens traveling to France. Remember Macron speaking disparagingly about Algeria in context of its, what they call colonial revisionism, I guess. How does this commemoration affect the relationship between these two countries?
it doesn't go far enough for it to have any positive effect. If you look at what the French have been receiving in terms of protests just in the last 2 days, you can see that it isn't going to go anywhere at all. The Algerian authorities have said that they expected it to be declared a massacre, what happened in Paris in 1961. The president of the association called In the Name of Memory, whose father was actually one of the demonstrators, he has also been calling for this to be called a massacre, saying people were assaulted, that it's not enough to say that it was unforgivable or inexcusable. So it's not going to go very far on the Algerian side. And when you think that at least 7 million people living in France are either Algerians or descendants of Algerians who moved here or descendants of settlers, this isn't going to go far enough. It possibly went as far as he could have gone, given that there is a French presidential election in just under 6 months' time, given that he has to be very careful not to alienate the right wing of his supporters who still feel that not enough was done within the French academic sphere to acknowledge what they went through in Algeria. So you've got these two competing sides. You've got the Algerians saying, let's look at what the French did in Algeria and how they treated Algerians in France. And then you've got some of the French soldiers and their families who served in Algeria who feel that they were badly treated, history has forgotten them, and in lots of ways, they're treated very unkindly by history.
That was reporter Linda Grandstein speaking with VOA's Jackson Mbunganyi. In South Africa, the country worst hit by COVID-19, on the continent, protests are increasing against a proposed government introduction of so-called vaccine passports. Citizens' access to public events and even workplaces will be severely restricted should the state give the green light to the proposal. But as Darren Taylor reports, that may be the only way open to the government to boost waning immunization rates.
After an initial rush to vaccinate, numbers of people getting the jab have dropped alarmingly. Only half of South Africans ages 50 to 59, an age group highly vulnerable to serious COVID-19, have had their shots. Even though science says the vaccines are extremely effective in preventing acute illness, hospitalization, and death from COVID-19, the health department says millions of people remain vaccine hesitant.
Me, I've said it many times, I have not been vaccinated and I will not be vaccinated.
Reverend Kenneth Meshwe, leader of the African Christian Democratic Party, or ACDP, organized protests around the country this weekend against mandatory vaccinations. He says he and many other Christians simply don't trust the vaccines.
Why should I subject myself to something that was not tested on animals? Only what has been tested on the animals can go into my body if necessary, but I don't want to be a guinea pig.
Meshwe doubts the science around vaccines because of what he calls mixed messaging.
We are now being told that within around 6 months, the vaccine will be losing its strength, and so people must go for another dose. And now again we are told there is going to be a booster. Why the hurry? They should have ensured that this thing is reliable. It takes an average of 10 years to manufacture and to come up with a vaccine in 3 months.
The state wants 40 million people of a population of 60 million vaccinated by the end of the year. But the health department says only 10.5 million have been fully immunized so far. To reach its goal, many in government want to pass legislation which would effectively force citizens to get the jab. Meshwe says this would be a human rights violation akin to apartheid.
I have never, and I don't think ACDP members would say, nobody should be vaccinated. Nobody was assisted by the vaccine. Nobody has said that. What we don't agree with is the use of force.
Business for South Africa, which represents thousands of private enterprises in the country, says a way has to be found, fast, to immunize a lot more people. Otherwise, a looming fourth wave will cause death rates to spike dramatically. Chairman Martin Kingston says vaccinations must increase from the current 200,000 a day to at least 300,000.
We have the vaccines, we have the facilities, we can go to people's premises to the extent that it's necessary to vaccinate them. The issue is, of course, one of demand. We need to generate as much demand as we can as a country. One of the ways that we can do that is by encouraging employers, indeed many establishments, to consider the possibility of mandatory vaccination. And then at the same time, both...
Kingston says not having proof of immunization could bar people from shopping malls and even places of employment.
We think that the combination of those factors should certainly drive up the level of vaccination, hopefully to try and get to the targets that we've already agreed are necessary by the end of the year.
Officially, the government says it's not going to force people to get the jab. Unofficially, sources close to President Cyril Ramaphosa tell VOA it's only a matter of time before a policy of mandatory vaccination kicks in. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
A UN report says millions of Zimbabweans will need food assistance until the next harvest, despite a bumper harvest in the previous crop. Reporter Kudzai Zvinavashe has more details.
This year, Zimbabwe harvested 2.7 million tons of grain, triple the 2020 production. World Food Programme Country Director Francesca Edelman speaks to VOA about the situation on the ground.
The difficulty is that the grain, which is mostly what we are looking at when we're talking about a bumper harvest, is not grown equally everywhere in the country. So that when there's a bumper harvest, some areas are very well off, and other areas have, you know, don't benefit from such a productive season.
She says because of this and other factors, millions of Zimbabweans are at risk.
Then there's also the issue that not everybody has access to large land and not everybody is able to produce with the similar type of inputs. So that means that in rural areas, more than 2.9 million people are still considered to be food insecure. So it's a very large number. And in urban areas, and there, of course, the disconnect is very clear between rural grain production and life in urban areas, meaning that 2.4 million people in urban areas are also considered to be food insecure. So all of that adds up to 5.3 million people still being in need of food assistance. Yeah.
While many wonder why so many are vulnerable, despite the impressive harvest nationwide last year, Edelman says there is a silver lining.
This year, of course, is much better. In previous years, the drought was much more pervasive throughout the country. The numbers of people needing food assistance are much higher than what we are seeing today. Last agricultural season was a good one. We hope that the next one is going to be a good one.
The prospects of rain are high, and many are pinning hopes that another bumper harvest is coming. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zvinavashe from Harare.
This December, Gambians will vote in what has been described as one of the most important elections in a generation. This marks the first election after the rule of Yahya Jammeh, whose brutal dictatorship crushed democracy in the West African nation, suppressing all forms of political dissent. Seine Merina, the editor-in-chief of Akamba Times, a Gambian digital news platform, told VOA's Jackson Funganyi that mass protests in Banjul over the weekend a testament to the role and power of the Gambian civil society in holding their government to account for promises made when the incumbent President Adama Barrow took power in 2017.
So the protest yesterday was meant to call on the government, you know, for victims to, you know, let them know, you know, how serious they are about the implementation, because they believe that with the recent political happening, you know, there is a lack of political commitment from the government to implement the Truth Commission recommendation. But barely 24 hours after the announcement of the protest, the government through the Ministry of Justice also issued a press statement for the first time, you know, reassuring victims, Gambians and international community that government is fully committed to the implementation of the TRRC report, which is expected to be submitted to the president not later than next month. So basically, government
responded in a positive way.
To the surprise of many activists, partners and stakeholders in the transitional justice process. They issue a very strong statement, saying that even they are planning to establish a reparation fund that will be taken to the National Assembly for the victims. So there was a dramatic U-turn from the government with regard to its commitment to the transitional justice processes, including the Truth Commission.
You know, Jammeh had brutally suppressed the civil society during his over 20 years in power. Mm-hmm. How active are the civil society groups in Gambia right now, and how have they evolved during this first post-Jammeh administration?
Thank you. That's a very fundamental question. As you rightly mentioned, civil society, like the media, were very oppressed during Jammeh's rule. But since the coming of the Barrow-led coalition government, there has been a significant steps taken by the civil society. They have reorganized, re-energized themselves, to take up their rightful places. And this has really, had impact in the current democratic process, because when this thing happened, they do organize protests. They do organize press conferences. They even petition the executive, and even go to National Assembly to make sure that lawmakers do the right thing for the country. So the civil society in the country have been very proactive during these past 4 years, unlike Jammeh's 22 years, where they were seriously affected by their operations been seriously hampered by Jammeh's dictatorial tendencies. So unlike before, now they are very active. They have been calling on protests. They have been conducting press conferences, petitioning the government on issues they think should be done. Also making sure that the promises made by the coalition government are fulfilled. So they have been doing very well. And yesterday's protest is a clear commitment of the steps taken by the civil society groups in the Gambia.
That was Seine Merene, the editor-in-chief of Akamba Times, a Gambian digital news platform, speaking with VOA's Jackson Vungani. Colin Powell, the former U.S. Secretary of State and chairman of the Joint Chiefs, has died from COVID-19 complications, his family said today. He was 84. In an announcement on social media, the family said Powell had been fully vaccinated. Powell was the first African-American to serve as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Secretary of State. Powell left behind an indelible reputation as a straight shooter who considered, then rejected, Iran for the presidency. Uganda's Minister of Health has begun treating river blindness disease among South Sudan refugees in northern Uganda. The effort, the first of its kind, comes nearly 2 years after the health ministry rolled out plans for mass treatment of river blindness in refugee settlements to eliminate threats of the disease. The World Health Organization says Uganda's efforts to eliminate it are being challenged by cross-border movements, especially where refugees carry the disease from endemic areas.
In renewed efforts to eliminate river blindness disease in Uganda, a mass treatment exercise targeting about 40,000 South Sudan refugees above the age of 5 has been rolled out in 11 refugee host districts. Uganda has made some strides following a transmission elimination policy launched in 2007. However, there are emerging threats of resurgence, with black flies spreading the disease in areas that host South Sudan refugees. David Ogutu is the program manager for Uganda's National Onchocerciasis Elimination Program. He told VOA News that treatment of refugees needs to be integrated into the elimination efforts if Uganda is to completely wipe out the disease.
When refugees come with parasites, they will be a source of reintroducing the disease in host communities where we shall have eliminated. So elimination policy to be achieved here, we need these refugees under treatment.
John Pasquale, the chairperson of the Palabek Refugee Settlement, welcomed the treatment of refugees in his community. Although he couldn't give specific figures, he says many refugees in his community have been left sightless by river blindness disease.
Because we live together with the host community and we do everything together, it's good that also we should be treated. It is meaningful that we may be integrated to the same process of treatment.
Over 50,000 doses of treatment drugs have been provided by the World Health Organization for refugees. River blindness disease is caused by a filaria worm that gets into a person's body through a black fly bite. The flies are found mostly in areas with fast-flowing rivers and streams, which are said to offer a favorable environment for their breeding. River blindness disease causes intense skin itching and discoloration, rashes and eye diseases that can lead to impaired vision and sometimes permanent blindness. Meanwhile, teams have also been dispatched to areas with reported resurgences of black flies to ascertain the magnitude of the threat. Moses Omoni, the coordinator for the River Blindness Elimination Program in Lamu District, address the challenge.
We have received concerns from our communities about the increasing numbers of flies, that is a black fly, since last year, around the months of November, December. However, the district is doing some investigations. We are trying to catch these flies and try to do some kind of analysis. Could it be that these flies are still infectious or they are non-infectious?
Uganda's government previously sprayed larvicide in all endemic areas, but says the method was costly. They are now resorting to slashing and clearing bushes along rivers infested with black flies. According to Kata Center, a non-government organization which has worked with ministries of health to eliminate river blindness in 10 countries in Africa and Latin America, most cases occur in Africa, where more than 120 million people are at risk and hundreds of thousands have been blinded. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Botswana says a planned elephant census in five South African countries will help guide the management of the more than 220,000 animals in the region. The area survey is planned for the May through August dry season next year. From Gaborone, Botswana, reporter Nkondisi Dube has the details.
Botswana is part of the Kavango Transfrontier Conservation Area, or KAZA, which also covers Angola, Namibia, Zimbabwe, and Zambia. KAZA is the world's largest remaining savanna elephant population at more than 220,000, with figures obtained from individual country censuses. Now the five countries are planning a joint first-ever area census to determine the exact numbers. KAZA Executive Director Nyambe Nyambe says the exercise is critical to avoid double or undercounting of the elephants, which frequently migrate across borders. Nyambe says the census will be synchronized, so simultaneous flights will use the same survey methods across the five countries. Botswana's Director of Wildlife, Gabelo Sinyatso, says the country will provide resources, including light aircraft, to be used in the survey. He says the exercise will help determine the seasonal distribution of the elephants within the region. Botswana has the world's largest elephant population at more than 130,000, but some of the animals are refugees that fled civil war in Angola. Wildlife management expert Maip Ives says the exercise is important, but the right personnel should be chosen to carry it out.
What is important is that the people analyzing the census data are qualified and not politicized. You know, you need to understand a lot about aerial census, about ground census, or any type of census for that matter, when it comes to animals as precious as elephant.
Ives adds it is vital to carry out the census, particularly due to the migratory nature of elephants.
Between Zimbabwe and Botswana, there is considerable seasonal movement, and we need to know exactly how many elephants are moving between these two countries and between Botswana and Namibia and Botswana and Zambia, for example. This is the core of the Southern African elephant range. The census needs to be carried out very methodically, very scientifically, and probably analyzed by a committee of international scientists, some who are not from the KAZA region.
KAZA countries have previously lobbied the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES, to allow trade in ivory due to the high number of elephant population in the region. Officials say the animals are increasingly involved in conflict with humans, encroaching on their territory and competing for available food. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Gaborone, Botswana.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I am Chinedu Okoye in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05.